Hello, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the endarkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyond Ananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Upwising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hi there. Welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed light on the endarkened corridors of power, and we shine light ahead of us to where evolution is leading. The purpose of Wiki Politiki is to bring left and right, front and center, to face the music and dance together, to address problems instead of defending positions. Well, one of the big problems with finding a commonly sensed, common sense consensus among citizens across the political spectrum is that, well, it's that we disagree. And these days, different political narratives can mean different realities. On last week's show, we featured a new documentary, The Reunited States of America, and how respectful, face-to-face, heart-to-heart communication can rehumanize the other and affirm beloved community. Well, and then what? Do we pretend that we don't disagree on fundamental issues and worldviews? Do we dance around these profound differences, or is there another way? Well, last summer, I interviewed two-thirds of a trio looking to create breakthrough in this regard. I interviewed Arthur Pena and Jacob Hess, who are two close friends coming from completely different worldviews. Jacob is a conservative member of the Church of the Latter-day Saints. Arthur characterizes himself as, quote, a gay libertarian Marxist. Well, our guest this week, Charles Randall Paul, is co-authoring a book with Arthur and Jacob called Inevitable Influencers: Why, Deep Down, We All Want and Need to Persuade Each Other of What We See as Good, Beautiful, and True. Well, all three of these gentlemen believe in the seemingly paradoxical peaceful tension that can be created when our hearts are unified in the field of love and coherence, while our beliefs might be totally in contradiction. Randall Paul seeks to turn our dueling dualities into dynamic duo dance partners, or as he calls them, trustworthy rivals, not coercive enemies. Randall Paul is the president of the Foundation for Interreligious Diplomacy. He is a native of New Jersey. He has a BS from Brigham Young University in social psychology. He has an MBA from Harvard. He worked as a business partner at Trammell Crow Company in the southwestern USA, where he developed many commercial real estate projects for 16 years. He then got a doctorate in 2000 at the Committee on Social Thought at the University of Chicago, writing his dissertation on methods for engaging in religious conflict without acrimony or violence. He is also on the executive board of the Society for Mormon Philosophy and Theology. He's an editor of the International Journal for Decision Ethics, and he served as a missionary for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in France and in Belgium. And he's held numerous callings since that time, including service as a bishop. Welcome to our show, Randall.
Good to be here, Steve. Thank you very much for the invitation.
Good. Well, we'll jump right in. You were raised in the Latter-day Saints tradition, and you continue to hold those beliefs, which are, you know, pretty definitive. So how do you reconcile holding those strong beliefs with engaging in what you call religious diplomacy?
I think every person who comes of age, I don't know when we become an adult, but it's a point where we realize that we're responsible for our lives in some way, and that we have to make our decisions based on some value system, whether it's from our parents, from a tradition, from the internet, from Walt Disney. We come to some conclusion and start living our lives according to some system that we gives us a hierarchical way of making decisions. Many of them are moral decisions, sometimes just very pragmatic. And I consider that kind of a universal condition for anybody that is not mentally disturbed. The reason I bring that up as a background is to say, I think on one level, everyone has a religious core, something that can't be proven true, but they take for granted, they trust it. And in that sense, when I engage people, whether they have a religious affiliation or not, I try to get to what they consider their hierarchy of value, or beliefs on which they would give their life, if you will. Either give it in terms of their workaday life, or in some cases, give it literally. That's always intrigued me about people. And when I came to realize that my core beliefs, my core trust was in the text that I'd read, the New Testament texts, I trusted the writers of those texts, that they were telling me a true story about Jesus. I trusted my parents. I trusted people that loved me, who've lived lives that I saw as lives of integrity, and came to realize that I was formed deeply by my religious upbringing, and there was no way of getting around that reality that every human being is brainwashed, if you will, is socialized into a system, and then they, at an adult level, they buy into it more or less. And so to answer your question, yes, I have bought into the tradition that I was raised in. I find it centers me whenever I'm engaging in difficult decisions in my life. I pray, presuming there's an objective reality outside me, a divine reality that in some way communicates with everybody that desires to touch base. And so when I go into a conversation with someone who disagrees with me about my doctrines or fundamental beliefs, I am curious about how they came to what they believe, and it opens it up to a conversation that is not defensive, but is truly oriented toward what one of my colleagues that you mentioned earlier, Arthur Pena, calls seeking the whole truth together. When you ask somebody this question, if your listeners remember anything I say today, this is the key. If you come out of a centered belief system of some sort, whether it's strict based on some religious tradition, or it's just some integrity that you find in your life that helps you work through things, when you're engaging someone else who has a contradictory and different belief system, the first question you should ask is, how did you come to what you hold most dear? How did you come to what you believe and would give your life for? That how-to question opens up a possibility of a personal sharing of narrative that inevitably will open your heart and mind to the person who's sharing that with you. You might think that their system is one that's completely irrational, or too rational, or just wrong. But when you have them tell you their own story of how they came to hold it and make the decision to hold it, it inevitably touches your heart and mind in a way that you see yourself in that person. You realize that you too had experiences that brought you to make a decision about who you want to be in terms of your beliefs. And it puts down the walls and allows you to share all sorts of things when you see another person as someone who is wrong, but bright and rational, who's wrong, but good-hearted, who's wrong, but not duped because they're being fooled, but that they just see things incorrectly, and you're trying to help them see them correctly. And we have found that, of course, when the key to the second thing that any of your listeners should listen to after this little monologue of mine is make sure it's mutual. In other words, when you're having that conversation, make sure that you listen to them tell you what they believe and where they believe you might be wrong or are wrong, and have your heart and mind open to their persuasion. Mm-hmm. And giving them the benefit of the doubt that they are trying to help you see the truth better than you currently see it. And so those two things are rules of thumb. One, find out how a person came to what they believe. And then two, make sure your conversation is for mutual influence, where you're open to hearing a critique as well as an appreciation of what you believe. So that was a long monologue for your first question.
Well, you know, what you introduced us, I would say one of the most underrated tools in our toolkit, which is curiosity. Curiosity is an amazing trait because it enables us to ask questions about things that we're not familiar with, and in hearing things, and again, as you said, even if we disagree. Several years ago, I started an email conversation with an ex-baseball player who I'd heard of, you know, many years ago, and remembered he was very religious, and he was a minister in his own church, and I knew he had very set ideas, and so we started a conversation. Some of it was about baseball, some of it was about theology. It was very interesting, and a friend of mine says, well, did you convert one another? I said, nah, neither of us are convertibles. We're both hard tops. So,
I like it. I would say after the good-hearted response you just gave, that you didn't convert as to content of doctrine, but I like to say you both converted each other to desire to continue a relationship of mutual interest, curiosity, respect, even love. So the conversion is at the social psychological level, not necessarily the rational doctrinal level. Do you see what I'm getting at there?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
There is a conversion. There is.
Mm.
It's how you feel about someone that's converted. You know, you went in probably, many of my people, when we bring people together in dialogue, they seriously go in with deep suspicion about the other person. How can they believe such craziness if they're on the right or the left? How have they been so duped? You know that the presumption of bad faith on the other party is it's just horrible. If we're successful, they come out of that engagement with a very different attitude about their rival or their opponent. They now say to themselves, wow, what an intelligent person. What an amazingly wonderful person. I think their motives are good. And now I see how they went wrong in their thinking. They took these experiences and made certain conclusions that I'm convinced are wrong. But at least I get it. And maybe I can be part of the answer to bring them to a higher light. And guess what? In that process, I learned a few things that I didn't know before. Mm-hmm. I expanded. I now even see my own tradition or belief in a different way after that conversation. So
you know,
both that have been grown.
You know, that brings me to another question, which is what was it that sparked you to look beyond your own tradition to seek something like religious diplomacy in the first place?
The first thing I think I have to say is I came from northern New Jersey in the New York suburbs, and I was raised in a high school where a third of the high school was Jewish, a third was Roman Catholic, and the other third were WASP. For your young listeners, a WASP is a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, right? And then there were four Latter-day Saints in the high school, about 600 students, and I was one of them. And no one knew what to do with me, right? I didn't belong in any clique. And yet, and this is back in the 60s. And so I became friends with each group. And what happened to me was that I knew I had the true religion. And I knew it was true, and the others weren't. And when I would go into their homes, I would be amazed at how happy they were, how wonderful their parents were, how things were going so well among these heathen, among these unbelievers, among these people who had long ago lost their way. And it became a right in my face, the realization that the God I believed in was taking care of a lot of people outside of my religion. And I had to come to terms with the goodness that I saw and the beauty that I saw in these other religions that I didn't have in mine. And I wrestled with that. That became one of the great questions for my life, is why a God that supposedly loved the whole human family was so parsimonious in giving truth to them. Why did he give it to such a few people in a few places, and everyone else was benighted? And so the long story short is, I both theologically and from social and psychological experience, I came to believe what's said in the Quran, actually, which is, if God had wanted to design the world so that we were all one tribe, he would have done so. But he made us plural tribes so that we could compete with each other in righteousness. And then at the last day after the resurrection, he would make everything clear. But I love that that idea. It's that God, for his own purposes to help us to be better, created a competition between religions instead of a competition that killed, where we kill each other. The competition was aimed to make us more righteous than each other. That's a very clever piece of work on the part of the divine. And so that's kind of part of my, that's where I am now in my life, that love between people who are family members or who are buddies is just too easy. As it says in the New Testament, if you'd only love your buddies and your friends and your family, you get no points in heaven. Jesus said, if you want to really go there, you got to love your enemies. And to me, that is undergirding everything I do, is that we have designed a world in which difficulty, in which disagreement creates a real price for friendship, a real price for love. You know when you love through difficulties and disagreements. That's the only where you get points in heaven. So I hope that was kind of an answer to your question.
Good. We're going to take a very short break. We'll be back with Randall Paul and talk more about why it's important to love thy enemy. Steve Behrman, Wiki Politiki, back very shortly.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio. IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern on Om Times Radio, and we'll explore these topics and so much more on Destination Unlimited.
COVID-19, brought to you by CDC and the Ad Council.
If you're feeling increasingly lonely right now, you're not alone. It's totally normal. Even though we may not be able to get together in person, connecting virtually with friends and family still gives you a chance to interact with people and may help raise your spirits. Join a virtual book club, set up group text chats, or online video coffee breaks with coworkers.
Find more self-care and coping tips at coping-19.org.
Thank you. we're back with our guest, Randall Paul, and we're talking about this intriguing idea of engaging people at the heart, even though we don't agree on the head level. Now, when you mentioned the word competition, this is really very interesting. You mentioned the word competition, and as you might know, in the original Greek meaning of the word, it didn't have anything to do with defeating anybody else or fighting anybody else. The word actually meant striving together. So in a certain regard, according to the Quran, as you say, all of these different religious perceptions are striving with one another together to achieve something. And you also used a phrase in your writing, collective purpose. So are you suggesting that many, if not all, of these rival religions and belief systems share a collective purpose?
I will say many do. I can't speak universally, but I like to say that when I use that phrase, I'll modify it a little bit. We have a collaborative, I feel actually a collaborative purpose.
Even better.
It's even more intense than collective. Collaboration comes from the root of working together, collaborate. And what are we working together on with rivals? Going all the way, what are we working together on in war? What is the goal? If you go into the negative, it's to accomplish something we couldn't accomplish by other means. We were trying to settle some disagreement by either killing enough of the other guy that we, quote, win, or not. So Georg Simmel, a famous German sociologist, said that any motive that brings you together is associative, not dissociative. And without getting it too much into the weeds, I'll just say that when two missionaries or two people who desire to persuade others of the right way of thinking that they have discovered or which has been revealed to them, and they're sincere about it, they desire of an audience. And when two of them come together, they are collaborating in providing each other an audience for their truth saying. And in that sense, there is no better audience for your truth saying than someone who deeply disagrees with you, right? That's an interesting audience. Why preach to the choir? That's not even really an audience. But when you have someone who deeply disagrees with you and who wants to listen to you carefully so that they can communicate back and persuade you that you're wrong, you have a deep, what we call contestational conversation. It's not contention. Contention is a word, I know you love words, that means twist or turn or aggressively change. Contestation comes from testate, to witness, to share a story with someone, to see. And so we find that contestation is what we do all the time in life. We try to persuade each other from something like as simple as, please pass the salt, to, will you marry me? All these things, there's a contest going on of whether or not another person will respond to your persuasion. And believe me, in anything that really matters, it's a two-way engagement. There's always a question of whether the response will be yes or no. And there's always a hearing, an ear that says, if it's no, then why? If it's yes, then why? And therefore, you're open to the other person's persuasion. And that's what we've got to bring back, we think, in modern discourse, is we need to elevate the idea of mutual persuasion being okay. Back in the 60s, it's I'm okay, you're okay, I'll tolerate you, just keep your private stuff to yourself, and let's go out and talk baseball and do business together. That is a shallow life. If you cannot have a conversation where you disclose your deepest beliefs with someone, you do not have a trusting relationship. It's not friendship. It maybe is a contract relationship, but friends are people who come to trust each other in their disagreements because they're allowed to take their clothes off emotionally, spiritually with each other, and really engage that way. And that's what we're all about. We're we collaborate by saying, I'm going to be deeply honest with you, and I'm going to listen to you, and you're going to do the same in return. That's collaboration. And we both want that, because out of that, truth, greater truth will come. A truth of at least how we see the world, and maybe for some people who believe in God or divine sources, maybe inviting that source into our collaboration, we'll both see something even beyond our own experience. Some new thing will be revealed to us in this experience. So a collaborative contestation allows for newness, surprise, and growth without giving up the integrity of your convictions.
You know, this is really interesting, because this is what I mean when I say that we turn dueling dualities into dynamic duo dance partners, and that in this regard, you actually create a dynamo. You create an energy that allows something new to emerge, something novel to emerge out of a conversation where people are simply sharing what they believe. And you said that you've certainly learned a lot of nuance from other people in these conversations. Now, if we look at the current, this is a new word to describe what we're going through, the situation that we have right now, where we've got, everybody knows what that word means, you know. Where we have essentially people living in different realities, where we have social media that reinforces the most extreme iterations of these belief systems. How do we constructively engage in these politically contentious times when people actually believe it's a life or death thing, my reality or your reality?
Beautiful question, and very much on the point. I'm glad you went there, because if we don't respond to that question, we're in ourselves, in an idealistic world, and we actually won't have much effect. As speaking as a social psychologist, I'll respond to you first, and then I'll come out of maybe more of a spiritual tradition. But one thing to do is, in that story of how people come to where they believe strictly and solidly something that they don't want to let go of, is to realize when we hear those stories that it is a foundational system of personal safety and control. Mm. The world drives us all crazy. We're little kids, and we start realizing, holy smokes, I can't control the world. So many bad things are happening to me when I'm 5 years old or 10 years old or whatever it is. And so every human being wants to get a grip on something that they can that can give them a feeling of personal safety. And if we don't allow every human being to have that problem, we're not being real. And so to look down on anybody because they're holding on to a belief system and say, oh, you weak person, you have a weak personality, you can't deal with ambiguity, you can't deal, well, holy smokes, the person who's making that critique doesn't see that their very view is they have controlled their lives by saying, oh, there's not everything that we can control. they've come to a view that they could be shattered. Their view could be shattered if there is an absolute truth someday, right?
Yes, exactly.
And they screwed up. And so, in other words, I try to give everybody in our work, we give everybody the benefit of the doubt that they're looking for safety and control in their lives, and as for themselves and their loved ones. And what happens, I think COVID's a beautiful example. What happens is we are in a pluralistic world now where everybody is sensing a contamination of their worldview. They're sensing, you and I might sit back, Steve, and say, oh, this is luscious. This is, look how we can grow. You know, look how much we're learning. Whereas from another point of view, it's, holy smokes, my kids are going to see they can have sex with anybody. My kids are going to see they can take drugs. My kids are going to do all sorts of things that'll break the commandments and send them to hell, right? This pluralism comes with a lot of crap. Yeah. And until we acknowledge that, we are not being real. We are not being open to the human problem that contamination is dangerous, right? And that comes with difference. And so this thing we're talking about is so wonderful between you and me, but try to talk with someone who hasn't been brought up in a culture that has the gift for gab, a culture that is very protective because they feel the outside world is so dangerous. Then when you realize that, you have to start by acknowledging their concern, not looking down on them as weak, but saying, instead of saying you have fear, say you have concerns for your loved ones, don't you? You have concerns that things could go awry in your life, and I do too, right? And so you start there at that level of mutual understanding of the world that is dangerous, and then go into the conversation on to say, what can we do about that? Is there any way to close down communication from the outside? And then silence all of a sudden is the usual response, even among the Amish, right?
Yeah.
Who have tried to close down, that they realize, you know, it's now impossible to just close down the outside. So what do you do about the contamination? And we like to say, well, we're now in the game of mutual contamination, where we go out and we spread our word, our view of reality, in a way that at least co-resists the other. And so we like to say coexistence is a crock. Coexistence implies you're on Mars and I'm on Jupiter, and we can coexist without any. This world is a world of co-resistance and collaboration. That's the socio-psychological reality of our world today. We are constantly resisting and collaborating with the same people all the time.
You know, that reminds
my monologue there.
No, it reminds me of a quote from one of your articles, which is, the world is designed for people to disagree and then decide what to do about it.
Yes. That's right. That's right. That goes back to my theme. From a theological standpoint, you could say, if you come out of a Christian background, the world is designed to create enemies and then decide whether or not you're going to love them. Right? And to convert them from being an enemy to being at first a trustworthy rival, and then maybe even a loving friend. And that's, you know, there's a, as we all know as humans, there's a hierarchy, if you will, of relationship. But I'll just leave it at that. Yes, if the goal is, the false goal is peace, the reasonable goal is peaceful tension, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what we like to say. If we can teach our children that the goal is not to get along by consensus, the goal is to live with those with whom you cannot come to consensus in a way that is mutually beneficial. That is the goal, and that is tough. That is work, right? And instead of saying, oh, if we only could all unify, if we can only have a universal come together on agreement, and I know many of your guests will probably think this guy's nuts when he says it's what separates us is more important to us social psychologically than what unites us. I think I can prove that in everyone's life. They care more about their kids than the kids down the street. They married Amy, not Sue. They made decisions that excluded others in order to create a unity. And so those unities are also separations. And when we realize that that's what the social psychological reality of life is, then we have to face the fact that we don't love everybody the same. And therefore, it's an amazing ethical decision that we make to marry somebody or to give or to join a company or to have a conversation between Steve and Randall. The time we've given each other is an amazing decision that we could have made with five other people that day, but we didn't. We chose each other. And so this particularity actually creates an exclusivity that leaves others out. And when we psychologically realize that, it makes every decision we make very potent because we are excluding. And we wish we could say, I want 7 billion people to be here on this conversation with Steve and Randall today. Let everybody have a voice. But we know that's impossible. And so I take it as a great gift when someone gives me some time. And I'm grateful for this experience that we have that allows us to love, particularly in a context where it's tough to make those decisions at times. But I'm getting off on a tangent perhaps here to give you a kind of a background for the fact that difference creates value. It creates the value. If everyone were totally equal, why be anybody? You know what I mean?
That's right. If you're going to be nobody, why be somebody? You know, why be anybody?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Go ahead.
This brings me to the question or comment that had you grown up in Salt Lake City, for example, rather than New Jersey, your perspective might be different. You might not have ever developed this this curiosity.
Yes, you're right. It would have come later. It would have come later when I went into perhaps graduate school or something like that. Mm-hmm. There's always a time when you get out of the bubble, and everybody's in a bubble, everybody. I was raised in the New York area in the 60s, and believe New York was the center of the universe, man. You know, when I went to work in Texas for my company, I was amazed that there was another culture out there. and they looked down on the East Coast, right? They thought we were, you know, we didn't get it. And so, yes, everybody's in a bubble. And yes, whether it was Salt Lake City I was raised or someplace else, I think eventually, since we're in a pluralistic world, I would have had my bubble popped. But I agree with you, though, in your implication, it would have been much later. I think, I don't know whether it's God-given or just luck that some people have personalities that are more curious, but my hunch is that my parents made my life feel safe, right? And that gave me the courage to explore. And I find so many people who don't feel centered, either psychologically or spiritually, don't want to explore. And another way of talking about curiosity is to say you're an explorer, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
I don't look down on those people at all. I realize what it is to be an explorer. It takes risk, and it could be that you were raised in a way where you just don't have the confidence to explore because you're holding on sometimes by the skin of your teeth to what you've been able to hold on to. But I was raised in a family, thank heavens, that gave me such love in my home that I think psychologically I was safe to go out and experiment.
We're going to take a very short break. We'll be back after the break and talk more with Randall Paul about how to have mutually persuasive disagreements. Steve Behrman on WikiPolitiki.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
The United States has the highest rate of incarceration in the world. At the Equal Justice Initiative, we believe mass incarceration has to end. There is this presumption of dangerousness and guilt that gets assigned to Black and brown people. We have to confront our history of racial injustice and commit to a new era of truth. There's something better waiting for us, something that feels more like freedom. truth can inspire change. Please learn more at EJI.org.
Well, we're back with our guest, Randall Paul, and we're really talking about this seeming contradiction and paradox of unity at the heart, and as we allow, in fact, invite contestation at the mental level, at the level of belief. And of course, the Swami says, "Truth lives in your heart; beliefs lie in your head." So, this is a heart-centered conversation where, paradoxically, we're seeking to persuade the other person, and yet we're simply not attached to whether they get persuaded. Am I honing in on this?
You are honing in on part of it.
Yeah.
Everything you said, Steve, comes from what I would call an Eastern point of view, where there is, so quote unquote, no harm in concluding something because it's probably wrong.
Right.
Whereas a Western point of view comes from, both in science, by the way, and in Christianity, and to a certain extent in Islam and Judaism, that there is a single truth, overarching single truth, that has, in the case of Christian, that has to do with Jesus Christ being the Son of God. Let's just go there, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if you don't get that right, it doesn't matter what else you do get right.
Mm-hmm.
So those are very different views of the world. And I implied, at least, from what you said, that you were moving from the left side, not left side, from the eastern side. And that, from my point of view, might be the truth. But I say the western side also might be the truth. And so I would say that when I deal with people who are convinced that it's vital to your spiritual well-being for in eternity, that you come to a conclusion now about what the ultimate truth is, I don't look at them and say, "You poor souls, you poor unenlightened souls, get under the Bodhi tree and get it right." I don't say that. I don't go there, because that would not allow me a true openness to them. They would feel my rejection and my closeness to that possibility. Even though I think it's wrong,
yeah,
I can at least see it as a possibility, and that allows them to be open with me to my persuasions. And so, on your point, when we were last talking about it too, it comes down to something like this. We're on the spaceship Earth. We are now confronted, let's say, with catastrophic global warming. And let's just say a group of us, millions of us, say it's a hoax, and we're not going to do anything about it. And another millions of us think, if we can't get together on this, the whole Earth is going to hell in a basket. This is not a matter that can be deferred until the next life. It's got to be a decision made today. And if these people don't get in with the program, what do we do? They will take the whole Earth down. What do we do? Well, one alternative is, let's kill them to save the Earth, right? If we don't kill them, they're going to kill everybody in their ignorance, right, in their non-action. I like to put things, Steve, very, very brutally, if you will.
That's a good brutal extreme. Yeah, that makes it very clear. Yeah, keep going with that.
There are decisions, both political decisions as to tax policy. Today, we've got to make that are make. Some people are going to live. Some people are going to die because of this stuff. And so, human decisions have to be made every day that will affect drastic results. And until we can face that as spiritual and religious and philosophical and social psychological thinkers, we're again playing in the clouds. We're not coming back and saying this stuff has real world implications. Quote, loving your enemy, dealing without coercion and in persuasion only. Well, what happens when a decision has to be made and someone has to coerce an end, right? That is where the rubber hits the road in a practical way. And we like to say in our group, let's put that out on the table as a clear reality that sometimes coercion is an alternative. But let's examine all possible persuasive engagements first. Let's try every possible way to evade the coercive possibility. Once that's been done, at least you're, if you lose in the coercion, if your team loses the vote and you're coerced by the vote to go in a certain way, say to put up with abortion or not, at least you know that your opponent or your rival does care about you, has heard you, and has not been persuaded by you. And there's a difference at that moment because you don't want to kill that person. You know what I mean? You feel differently about them. And that's the best we can do. That's why we like to say peaceful tension is the best place we can be. It's very difficult to get beyond that without coercing people either to say they believe something when they really don't, or literally exiling them or eliminating them from the world.
Well, you know, we do have those kinds of situations right now. We had something happen on January 6th where there were people who sincerely believed that if they didn't invade the White House, that they would be subject to the tyranny of the deep state, to the tyranny of forced vaccinations and all of these other things. And in tuning in and listening to some of those people, it was very clear that this was a life or death decision, that in their own regard, they were protecting Anne Frank in their basement, so to speak. And that.
Oh, wow. What a powerful analogy, Steve.
That's the most powerful analogy I could come up with, because it's about when do you not tell the truth? Cannot tell a lie. Anne is in the basement. Go get her. You know, I mean, that's kind of that moral dilemma. So in a condition where people are so convinced that it's life or death, and it might very well be, because there are people who go, you know, if everybody doesn't take this vaccination, then we're going to have this horrible social situation. And then there are other people who go, you know what, vaccinations have not been proven safe. I'm not going to take one. And we also have the same thing about climate change, etc. So in a situation where the side that wins, quote unquote, has the power to apply the power of coercion, you know, we're in charge of the government, we could do this. How do you maintain this space of the heart where I'm going to have to arrest you, but really I don't hold it against you?
You just answered that question with your very statement there. I'm going to arrest you, put you in jail, or force you to be vaccinated I'm going with these ideas. And I wish I didn't have to do this, because I know you believe it's badly wrong. But most of us here on this earth think it's the right thing to do to save us. Now, in some sweet by and by, if there is a life after death, we might be proven wrong. And if so, the justice of God or karma, we will have to suffer that. But right now, I want you to know, you know, there's this line, this famous, who was it? The famous mystic, the Muslim mystic who was beheaded in the Middle Ages. Oh, Al-Ajaj, I think his name was. Before he was beheaded, he looked at the executioner, and the executioner knew he was a saintly person. And the executioner said, I really wish I didn't have to do this. And he said, oh, don't worry about it. If you had seen what I have seen, you wouldn't be doing this. But if I were in your position, I would cut my head off. I would be cutting my head off. In other words, there's this moment when both parties, both rivals, can look at each other not in anger, but in acceptance of the fact that they really are convinced of different things, and that this is just the way the world is. At times, that means you will have your head cut off. The best Christian analogy to that is Thomas More, who, when, and this is on the record actually, when he was condemned by the judges of the church in England for not assenting to the marriage of Henry VIII, not believing that divorce was valid in that case, when they finally gave the verdict of guilty and he knew he was going to have his head cut off, he said to them, he said, you know, St. Paul was persecuting the Christians, and he stood by holding the coats of the people that stoned St. Stephen to death. But on his way to Damascus, the Lord appeared to him. Now in heaven, St. Stephen and St. Paul are together. And then he looked at his accusers and said, it is my hope that even though you today have condemned me to death, that in heaven we will yet see each other eye to eye. And there's that resignation that you, with integrity at times, will lose to another person who, in their integrity, has to take you down, given the situation. I can only say that, as I've tried to say earlier, if what we can do is to make sure we've used every possible alternative to allow the person to live, to allow the person to thrive in their difference. And when it comes to not being allowing it to feel deep regret that you couldn't come to that, that there's no, you're not looking down on a person, and you don't see the person who's taking you down as someone who is killing you or taxing you evilly, but they're doing it out of a sincere belief in the truth that they've come to. I hope that was helpful in an answer.
It really is. I mean, and of course, there is a certain equality of spirit that you're talking about, that's where the equality exists, and recognition of the equality of spirit, despite differences in belief. And, you know, you would say, well, they're wrong. That's hard for me, but yeah. I understand that. And I will say, you know, I believe certain people are wrong as well. In the final 5 minutes we have left, what experiences have you had in this endeavor that assure you that you're on the right track with this?
I like the verb you used, assure, meaning in sense of assurance, but not absolute knowledge.
Yeah.
That I'm on
track.
Right?
Well,
I can say this, that we started out 20 years ago at the Foundation for Religious Diplomacy, following in our with the hypothesis that we could create this psychological change in rivals if we brought them together in private meetings and had these experiences that I've discussed today, where they tell each other the story of how they came together, and then they can discuss their sincere and significant differences. And we have had many successes doing that. Where we have not had successes is where we have expanded it to larger groups. In Egypt, for example, a few years ago, we arranged the first meeting between rabbis from Israel and teachers at Al-Azhar, the university, the Sunni university in Cairo. They invited the teachers, the rabbis, to come and have a conversation, a dialogue. It was private. Two people with two other people.
Mm-hmm.
The press, we were stupid. We let the press know about it, thinking that we would get more publicity and this would be a good thing. Well, it turned out that the press in Egypt is either on one side or another, and they'll use any information and twist it to fit their own program. And of course, it came out the next day, one of the newspapers, that Al-Azhar brought two Israeli spies.
Hmm.
Right? And of course, the teachers who had brought them were put on leave and their tenure was canceled. And we've had to work for 3 years to get them back into a position where we proved that they weren't spied on by these rabbis. And finally, they're back in school. But it's that kind of thing where we were brought to a real-world realization that what we're doing is so radical in some places, so radical and so dangerous to the people involved, that you need to keep it private. You need to keep it quiet to start something. So there's a success, but also a failure. And it's going to be slow work. We're working now in Iran on some very important dialogues that we're trying to make public for the first time. And we hope that they will be between Iranian and American religious leaders talking about some theological questions of friendship and conflict that might involve changing views of political and economic policy. So this is slow work, Steve, very slow, but we have seen success on the personal basis. So yes, if you can get two people or four people, if you get more people in the room than about five on a quote side, it changes the whole dynamic. The people start looking at each other. So our success is with small groups and having them influence other small groups.
Well, those people in the small groups can then have influence in their groups and they can expand. Thank you, Randall Paul, for joining us today on WikiPolitiki and giving us some food for thought. This is Steve Behrman. We'll be back next week on WikiPolitiki Radio.